Born in 1790, the American Democratic Experiment lived a good full life. Born to 13 parents, some male, some female, she grew up with dreams and aspirations. After graduating from the Industrial Revolution, she played a critical role in saving the planet from two world wars, ending slavery, passing the Civil Rights Act, providing for equality, and helped bring the world real football. But sadly, we have to report that last week, the American Democratic Experiment passed away. But have no fear, even though rule by a democratic vote of the people is no longer with us, we do have 9 judges for life who promise to lead us into the next century. So while we mourn her passing today, we raise a toast to the United Oligarchy of America in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, the comedian of law, and with us again is Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm still standing. Here I am.
You are still standing, and this week has been a humdinger of a week at the Supreme Court. We have a lot to debrief, and so let's just get right into it because there's a lot of great cases. Let's start off with... How about the Bostock v. Clayton County case? The Supreme Court issued that decision this week. It involved, in essence, there were some employers who allegedly discriminated against some employees and terminated their employment due to their sexual orientation. Now, I say allegedly. These cases were before the Supreme Court at the motion to dismiss stage. And so there really was no proof that that's what they did. And they contested that is why they terminated these particular employees. And in another case, you had a person who was a transgender person who also was terminated because of their transgender status, allegedly. And so the issue is, does Title VII, which prohibits discrimination based upon sex, in the employment context, does that also include sexual orientation? And so this was a huge, huge case, landmark decision. Mackenzie, what were your thoughts when this case came down?
Well, I have to say I was anticipating opinions that were coming out Monday morning because we all know that the court announces when they're going to announce their opinions.
We knew this decision was coming because it's one of the cases left on the docket.
Correct. So we knew that, you know, within the next couple weeks or so, the big opinions are going to come out. So I had my internet browser pulled up to the New York Times, and I was just waiting to see, you know, what it was going to be. And I clicked on the headline right away when I saw it. And I opened the actual slip opinion instead of reading commentary. I like to go right to the opinion.
Right.
And I have to say, when I started reading, you know, the outcome, you kind of scan through and scroll through, kind of like when you get a ruling in a case that you're working on, you want to see the result first of all, and then go back and read, you know, the court's reasoning. And I got really emotional. I mean,
really?
I really did. Yes, I did. And I don't know if it's, you know, it's just been a long couple months and it feels like there's been so much negativity going on and just something good had to happen. But I really did get emotional, and I got especially emotional when I saw that it was 6-3, because, you know, we've had a lot of 5-4 decisions in the past few terms, and just to get 6-3 is by no means unanimous, but it's a decision where, you know, no one can say, well, this one person went crazy and this is just, you know, Obama judges. It was Neil Gorsuch and John Roberts, like, voting with the majority. And it just made me so happy to feel like, you know, finally something good that the vast majority of Americans can, like, celebrate as something right that happened. And we really just, we needed this. Like,
well,
just needed as a society something good to happen.
You say celebrate. I say the week that American democracy died. But you know what? It's just all looking at it from a different perspective, and I'm going to unpack why I think that. But nonetheless, you really like this opinion. It got you. Now, Did this surprise you? In other words, let's just go back to Monday morning at 8 o'clock before the decision came down. What were your thoughts? Did you think you were going to win this case, or did you think that you were going to lose 5-4?
Well, I mean, look, I definitely anticipated a 5-4 decision. I think at this point, it's fairly safe to say that Roberts is kind of a swing vote on, you know, a not insignificant portion of issues. So I didn't, you know, I wouldn't have been totally shocked either way, I guess. But when I saw that it was 6-3 and that Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, had written the opinion, I mean, I was flabbergasted. I really was.
Now, if you go back to the oral argument, and I did a podcast after the oral argument, definitely taught several classes on this. My take has been, I think this is going to be a 5-4 decision, and the swing vote was going to be Kavanaugh, because if you listen to the questioning during oral argument, it was clear that Roberts was not going to side with the employee, was going to side with the employer, saying that this was sexual orientation is not a protected class under Title VII. And Gorsuch as well was, he was very much opposed to the employee's position during oral argument. And so I thought Kavanaugh was going to be the swing vote. And so I was really shocked to see it was a 6-3 decision and Kavanaugh was in dissent and Gorsuch and Roberts were in the majority. Now we're going to unpack a little bit later why you can't read too much into Roberts' vote along the majority. He might have done that strategically just to assign the opinion. But nonetheless, there has been a lot of uproar over this decision. Again, my take is this might have been the week that the American democracy died, and I will explain that in just a bit. But here's my question for you. Is it possible that you can agree with the decision or the outcome? Hey, the outcome is good. I like this outcome, but yet really strongly disagree with how they got to that outcome and think that the how you got there could be very dangerous to Americans. Is that possible?
Yes. I mean, I agree with 90% of what you just said. I think it's I mean, look, I did some research into this, and according to a Reuters poll conducted last year, 92% of American voters believe that employers should not be allowed to fire someone based on their sexual orientation or their transgender status.
Oh, I agree. And McKinsey,
so
I got to tell you,
this is not controversial. Right. Like, it's not a controversial result.
I got to tell you, I was shocked when I even saw that this case came out. I thought, really? You mean someone in the 21st century is firing someone because of their sexual orientation? Give me a break. Who are the Neanderthals out there doing that? And so I am a conservative. I'm not ashamed of it. I admit it. And I was like, no, you can't do this. You can't, in a secular place of employment, you can't fire someone because of their sexual orientation. Who would do that? I mean, I am a Christian. I'm not ashamed of that. And I openly say I'm a Christian. McKenzie, I live my life with this thought of WWJD. Do you know what that means?
Yeah. What would Jesus do?
No. What would Jesus drive? Clearly, he would drive a Ford truck. He was a carpenter. I would drive a Ford truck. But no, yeah, it's what would Jesus do? And in my
heart, oh my God, my husband must be Jesus.
That's right.
Yeah, great.
And if you've seen pictures of Jesus's sandals, they're all dusty and dirty. So it must have been a Ford truck because it was obviously broken quite a bit. He had to walk. But nonetheless, that aside, it is WWJD. What would Jesus do? And I really believe that this is just my personal take, but if Jesus were the employer, he would not terminate an employee because of their sexual orientation. Everyone has a right to eat food. You have a right to have a house over your head. I don't care what your sexual orientation is. You have that right. And so an employer, especially a secular employer, should not be terminating someone because of their sexual orientation. So I agree 100% with the outcome of this case. But wow, how they got there, I am telling you, they blew up the American democratic experience. And so what is your take on that? Do you agree with me, or do you think I'm the crazy bin?
No, I don't think you're in the crazy bin. And I think, I mean, first of all, it's so hard to talk about these cases sometimes as a lawyer and as someone who has litigated you know, I mean, for you at the Supreme Court level and who's litigated, in my situation, at least, you know, constitutional issues, or I litigate, you know, federal statutory issues all the time. And so, not to toot our own horn, but we do know more than the average person about the legalities of what's going on here. And so it's very difficult, I think, to talk to people, and I think you put it really well, on a human level about what's right and what's legal are sometimes two totally different things. And so I do agree with you. Look, I read the opinion word for word. I think there are some logical weaknesses in the opinion, especially, I will point out, where I think Gorsuch really kind of glosses over the transgender issue and doesn't really sufficiently tie in how his textual interpretation, I mean, I was kind of left scratching my head, and we can talk about it, about how his textual interpretation really applied. I had to read that paragraph several times, and I'm still not quite sure I understand fully his reasoning on that issue. I mean, I do get what he's saying about sexual orientation is because of sex, but with transgender, you have to go back to the sex assigned at birth, and then it's different. And, you know, I just was left scratching my head about the rationale, how that exactly squared supposedly with.
As the dissent said,
what he was saying.
I believe it was Kavanaugh who wrote the dissent here. And so as what Kavanaugh said, it was like, look, was it Alito who wrote the dissent here? It was Alito. Yeah, Alito.
Both of them wrote a dissent.
Right. Alito wrote the main dissent. And in his dissent, he said, look, there's one word for this. It's legislation. And so if you look at the history here, clearly the Congress did not intend to include sexual orientation in 1964. No one is even doubting that. In 1964, there was no indication whatsoever that Congress was intending to include sexual orientation as a protected class. You cannot discriminate based upon the sexual orientation. Even RBG admitted to that as much during oral argument. And there's been many efforts since 1964 to change the law to include a sexual orientation as a protected class under Title VII. It's never passed. And so here, as Alito pointed out in the dissent, this is just pure unadulterated legislation. They could not get this passed through Congress. Maybe this is a good law to have. And so the Supreme Court, let's just take this upon ourselves to update this law. And so do you agree with that's what the majority was doing? They were just simply updating these laws, creating legislation because Congress couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, yes and no. You know, it's hard to fully, you know, disagree with all of the points that Alito makes in his dissent, because like you pointed out, it's almost impossible to argue that these protections were quote unquote in Congress's mind when they passed Title VII. And obviously back in 1964, you know, the language, at least for sexual orientation, did exist. I mean, there were homosexual people, obviously,
right.
Back then. And, you know, people had a language for it. It wasn't some unknown thing. I mean, with respect to transgender individuals, I don't think that language really existed yet. So there is, on this point, I think, more of an argument in support of Gorsuch's position. However, you know, we can't, obviously, I think the Equality Act, which would have specifically expanded these workplace protections inter alia to homosexuals, it first was introduced in 1974. And like you pointed out, it has never passed. It's just stalled out in one body or other of Congress, and it just has never, you know, Congress has never gotten the job done. So I think where I would disagree with you is when you say this is the week that democracy in America died, because in my opinion, it's been dead at least since 1974, and probably, you know, much longer than that. But on this particular issue, I mean, how can Congress be so dysfunctional that they can't pass a law supported by 92% of Americans?
Right, right.
And I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that there are so many issues that are not controversial, and the fact that we pay our lawmakers lots and lots of taxpayer dollars, they should at a minimum be able to pass legislation supported by 90%+ of Americans. Like, this stuff should not be difficult, and it should not be stalled out in Congress, 46 years after being introduced? Come on, guys. Like, yeah. So is this an activist decision? Yeah. Like, I don't know how you say it's not.
In the podcast as when you admitted, yes, this is an activist opinion. And I agree with you on that. I wish the majority just owned up to it. So, yes, we are trying to update this law. We are engaging in legislative activity because Congress wouldn't do it. At least then it would have been an honest opinion. That's what's going on. No, maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe that's how our democratic system, it works nowadays. Because, as you know, if you research the history of our nation, at the beginning of this checks and balances, you have three different branches of government. And by design, the judiciary branch is the weakest branch. They have no enforcement power whatsoever. They only rely on the esteem, the respect that the public and the other branches give to the Supreme Court. I mean, they don't have their own army. They can't enforce their own rules. I guess they have a couple of 85-year-old bailiffs, but that's not going to do much for enforcing their laws. And so they have to rely on the respect. And maybe what's going on is they are gauging the interest of the public. They're sticking their wet finger out in the wind, seeing which direction the wind is blowing, and ruling accordingly. And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. But that is what we have here. We have 9 people deciding these issues for the entire American public, and you can't vote them in and you can't vote them out. And at some level, I definitely have a problem with that kind of judicial activism. But you know what? If they get the result right, I guess, is that a bad thing? I am really struggling with that part of the decision.
Yeah, it's tough. And I think there's maybe a point to be made that, you know, it happens all the time with legislation where a court will either strike down a piece of legislation or uphold it. But the real, you know, and courts sometimes even say in the decision, like, the legislature should deal with this. I think Kavanaugh even says in his dissent here, like, Congress should act on this. Like, this is something that clearly needs to happen, but because we're a court and not a legislature, like, we can't do it, basically passing the buck and saying, here, guys, do your job.
Right. Interesting.
And I think in this situation, there might be a point to be made where, like, it's not just the American people who have lost faith in Congress. Like, and that's clear. Like, the approval ratings of Congress are, like, right. Like, -47% at this point. But also the court. And maybe the court, you know, kind of realizes, or at least a couple of justices realize, like, if we don't decide this, what I'll say, the right way,
right.
in favor of these protections, we can't trust that Congress will do the no-brainer and, like, pass the Equality Act. Like, we can't even have faith that our elected representatives will pass legislation supported by over 90% of the country, and therefore we have no choice but to do what is morally right. And, you know, in our system of checks and balances and in our constitutional system, does it suck that it's at that point? Like, yeah. Well, I feel like my taxpayer money is being wasted, but, like, maybe they just realize, like, that's where we are. And if the choice is between doing what's morally right and morally wrong, like, we're going to go morally right on this one.
So you're saying they got this one right. And I got to admit, I am not opposed to the outcome. In fact, I think, as I already said, I'm actually in favor of the outcome. I don't think in a secular place of employment, people should lose their jobs because of their sexual orientation. So I think that is a good outcome. But there is a lot of danger when you are going to allow 9 unelected people who are pretty much they don't have to account to anyone. They have life appointment for their position. You let them decide these very significant issues, because there are other areas in this area of law that there would be some disagreement on. And so why are we going to allow the court system to decide these issues? And so let's unpack some of them. The first issue that was brought up in the dissent would be Title IX when it comes to sports. And will this decision not destroy women's sports. And so I dug up Title IX, and this is what it says in Title IX. Title IX is the main law that says, hey, in the you know, colleges and high schools and things like that, they have to have equal opportunities for women's sports as for men's sports. And so that's the basic gist of Title IX. This is what the actual law says. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any educational program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And so you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. Now, the only difference between this law and Title VII is instead of the word because of, it says on the basis of. And I got to tell you, there's no difference, at least not in any normal understanding. And so how will this not destroy women's sports? Do you have a take on that?
Well, I mean, I have a question. So my understanding, and it, you know, this isn't my area of specialty, but my understanding of how Title IX works, at least with respect to college sports, is that women's sports must receive equal funding to men's sports at the collegiate level. Is that correct? I mean, does Title IX mandate that women be allowed to participate in men's sports if they want to? Like, you can just try out for the, you know, baseball team if you're a woman at a college or whatever, or is it more of a funding?
The answer is yes and yes. I just read for you the law. And so it definitely has been applied in that, hey, look, you have 10 guy sports, you need 10 women's sports as well. And so that's how it has been interpreted, obviously interpreted or enforced in one respect, but it says there should be no discrimination on the basis of sex. And so I'm going to give you the hypothetical, because this will happen. I guarantee you this will happen. I am a coach of tennis. I guarantee you this is coming down the pipe. Will have a guy who wants to go out for the girls' team. There's a lot of benefits for it. Number one, a scholarship, free education, not bad. Or maybe they're transgender and they feel like they want to be on the women's team. So they go, and the women's coach says, no, you can't be on our team. Well, why not? Because of your sex. That is discrimination on the basis of sex. It doesn't matter that there is a guy's team, because under the reasoning of this opinion, sex played a factor in the analysis. And so because of that, boom, you cannot discriminate. And so I think this is going to have a real negative impact when it comes to Title IX. Your thoughts?
I mean, maybe this is one of the areas where it is going to force, you know, Congress back to the table, because I don't think anyone wants
exactly
that outcome. I mean,
no, it will destroy women's sports.
And I'm a woman. It's easy for me to say because I suck at sports. So, like, I'm not getting a scholarship to do anything, like, at all that has to do with anything physical.
Right, right.
So, for me personally, it's hard to feel like, you know, that passionate about it on a personal level, but I definitely don't want to see women's collegiate sports get destroyed or, you know, not, you know, have some kind of horrible outcome. I do think there are questions, there are definitely questions with the language, and I don't know how to parse on the basis of sex versus because of sex. Like, I can't think of a way to parse that where it would have a substantive difference.
No,
I really can't.
You can't. But here's what they will do. It is my prediction. The court will, because there's already been a case filed in this. It is going on. Actually, I know some of the attorneys that are involved in this case, where in the high school setting, a transgender athlete competed in the women's side of the sports, qualified for the state competition, excluded some other biological women from the state competition. They won first and second place, won the gold and silver, and excluded, again, the biological females from winning those positions. And so they were harmed both from esteem of not winning the medals and then also college scholarship opportunities, things like that. So lawsuits already percolate. Here's my prediction. The Supreme Court will find some way. Again, these guys are geniuses. They stick their fingers in the wind to see how it's blowing. Say, no, we can't rule that way. That would be ridiculous. And so we're going to find some way to rule on the side of biological female sports. Otherwise, I believe that they would destroy sports. But the point is, why? Now they are going to make these decisions. Is the Supreme Court really the place to make these kind of decisions? why shouldn't Congress be making these decisions? And here, they're going to have a real hard time distinguishing between the two, though I predict somehow they will.
Yeah, and sadly, you know, I agree with everything you said. Like, no, the Supreme Court should not be making these decisions. I don't want unelected justices who serve life tenure to have, you know, free reign to decide, especially issues of social, I mean, especially anything, but like, you know, these very important issues of social policy. And, you know, it clearly is a legislative issue. But again, like, I go back to, we have to, I think the place to start as, you know, Americans is right. Like, get rid, like, literally just vote out everyone in Congress.
Right.
Install me as national dictator. I will take care of it. Only I can fix this.
Hey,
I would vote for you.
But
I mean, really, something needs to be done on that level. And then I think that the court will kind of, I do have faith that if Congress started functioning and doing its job, that the court would be very pleased
to retreat
into the background on these issues. I feel that especially John Roberts and in this case, Neil Gorsuch felt forced, like their hand was forced. I do. I have to believe that.
Why
I don't
do you
think
say
they
that?
Were like, yay, we get to be activists. Well, because they're conservatives. I don't think they're celebrating, you know, being activists and legislating from the bench. I do believe that, you know, they have ideals and they want to stick to their principles.
I gotta disagree with you on this one. I think they are they're full born activists. They have drunk the Kool-Aid. They are full born activists. Now they might be conservative activists, but they're activists. They wanted this outcome, and they knew that Congress couldn't get there, and so they were going to take it upon themselves to get there, and that's an activist court, and so I think they did it. Now, there is some question as to whether or not Roberts did that. Here's what I'm talking about. How the Supreme Court works is that whoever's in the majority, so let's say you had a 5-4 split, so there's a majority of justices, right? The most senior justice in that grouping gets to decide who writes the majority opinion. And that makes a huge difference. And so here, when I believe it was Gorsuch that said, no, I'm going with the majority. And once he made that decision, then Roberts had to join the majority in order to assign the opinion. Because if Roberts had been in dissent, then that would have meant RBG had the most seniority and would have been able to select who wrote the opinion and would have probably read very much differently. And so it's kind of hard to predict what caused Roberts to be in the majority. Maybe he just felt that was the right decision, or maybe he joined the majority so he could assign the opinion to Gorsuch and have it be written strictly as a textualist opinion and not creating some kind of fundamental right under the Constitution. But that's just one different way to look at it. Let me give you another hypothetical, very similar. We just talked about college sports. What about professional sports? When it comes to, I'll throw tennis again as an example. You could use the WNBA, any female, even golfing, you use it. It is an employment situation. How are now all the rules regarding the tennis profession, how are they not now subject to Title VII and now illegal? And let me tell you here, Mackenzie, we're not talking about chump change. If you win a female tennis tournament, it's worth millions of dollars. We're not talking about chump change here, just some kind of, oh yeah, they're in school, no one's going to go play a different sport, they want to play with a guy sport. We're talking millions of dollars or on the line here. How does this not destroy professional women's tennis?
Well, I mean, you think that a man is going to say, I want to compete in a women's professional tennis tournament? So
absolutely, because here's why.
To join the Women's Professional Tennis Association and abide by the dress code?
Exactly. Let me tell you why. And by the way, the dress code also probably doesn't apply. But let me just tell you why they would do that. The average speed of a serve for a female player, a professional player at the top of the ranks, is on par with a Division II tennis player. They're not even close when it comes to the actual speed of their shots. You know how much money your Division II tennis player makes as a career tennis player? Squat.
I have no idea.
Squat.
Nothing.
Zero. He is going down flipping burgers somewhere or selling cars. He's making $0 as a professional tennis player. Do you know how much Serena Williams makes? A little bit more than that. I'm telling you, this is worth millions of dollars to enter in these tournaments. You don't think that within several years that's not going to be the outcome?
I mean, I definitely think there are going to be, like, these cases are going to crop up. There are going to be test cases, and there are going to be, like, it's going to force, and, you know, this goes back to the fundamental question, like, it's going to force more court cases, and unless Congress does something before it gets to that point, like, you're right. I mean, the court is going to be put itself in the unenviable position of having to come up with a rationale for discrimination in professional sports and collegiate sports, I guess.
And that's Title VII. That's not even saying how will this apply to Title IX. That's Title VII right then and there. And so they're going to have to find some way to say, oh, no, we didn't. I know we said on the basis of sex or because of sex, as long as sex is some kind of distinguishing criteria. Yeah, that we meant that for other cases, but not for sports cases. That is the problem, from my opinion, of legislating from the bench. They can't consider all of these issues, and now they are going to be the deciders of it. No one voted them into office. Well, you think I am done with my examples? I am not. I have another one. Public accommodations. And so let's go ahead and look at public accommodations. We're talking about the dressing rooms at various health clubs and things like that. Now, one could argue, because I've already looked this up, public accommodations does not include sex as a protected class. And so I do know that the dissenting Alito mentioned bathroom usages and some of those things in public accommodations. I looked up the law, and sex is not a distinguishing characteristic or protected class under Title II, public accommodations. But when it comes to, again, employment, that would be a factor, though I don't see that actually coming up too often. But when it comes to your job, then Title VII would apply to the bathrooms at your workplace, but not when it comes to public accommodations. However, some state public accommodation laws do include sex as a protected class, and so that might open up various litigation along state ground routes. Any thoughts on when it comes to bathrooms and dressing rooms with this whole Bostock precedent now?
Well, I do have thoughts, but it's not even like a legal thought. So as you know, I'm a liberal, so I think everything's better in Europe. That's part of our definition.
Right.
Like how
better.
You get your, you get your liberal card. You know, there are several criteria, but one of them is, do you think everything's better in Europe? If you click yes, you know, you're on your way to becoming a liberal.
Right.
So I actually lived in Italy for a couple of years, you know, a while ago. It was like 15 years ago. But over there, and it's pretty common throughout Europe, they have single sex bathrooms. They just have, you know, like bathrooms that anybody can use. And in a lot of restaurants, there are like closed stalls. So the doors and the walls go actually all the way floor to ceiling.
Okay.
So you go in, there's a lot of privacy, and then there's just like a row of sinks that, you know, anyone can use.
All right.
It's not rocket science. Like, nobody feels attacked. You go into your stall and you lock it. Like, no big deal. No one's offended by washing their hands next to a man or next to a woman or next to a transgender individual. Like, it's really not that difficult. And when I know that when some of my European friends like come here and use public bathrooms, they're like, do you guys know you can like see through the cracks in the door? Like, they have a huge problem with the way we do public bathrooms. I'm like, I know, this is terrible. Like, why are we doing this? I have no idea. I have a liberal card. Everything's better in Europe. So,
fascinating.
You know, for me personally, even, I mean, I guess like health clubs there, they do obviously have a men's locker room and a women's locker room, but they're just much more, generally speaking, not to stereotype, but they're much more blasé about, you know, even using a changing room, that there's like a man in the changing room next to you. Like, people just don't care. And I really wish it was like that here. Like, I wish people would just stop caring. And, you know, stop being so like fake modest about offended about these things. Like, just stop caring, and then you don't have to be outraged about it. That's my take. It's not a legal take, but
I appreciate that. In fact, I've said similar things in my classes. I said, hey, look, and Mackenzie, this is true. If you come over to my house, come over for some barbecue, I'm afraid to say we only have a single sex of bathrooms. We don't have a guy's bathroom and a girl's bathroom for you. You're just gonna have to use the one bathroom that we have, all of our bathrooms are single sex. So I get what you're saying. Apparently we are European. I had no idea we were that progressive in my household, but yeah, it's just not that big of a deal. I always thought that the reason why we separate the men's bathroom from the female's bathroom is because of women don't want to go to bathroom where guys go to bathroom. It's just not as clean as the girls' bathroom. And that's just reality. Call me sexist if you will. I've been in both, and the guys' bathroom is not up to the code. It's just not.
Well, maybe, but making all of them together would be a higher standard of cleanliness applied to all the bathrooms.
Oh, you think that's
going to
work?
So really, yeah, you guys aren't going to drag us down with you. We're going to pull you up to our level.
Oh,
you know, I will give you a brief anecdote. It was, I got to say, about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was when the public bathroom issue was kind of like a hot button issue or in the press. I went to a Broadway show with my mom and my sister up in Manhattan, and intermission rolled around, and about, 90% of the audience was female. It was a matinee, like on a Saturday.
Right.
And so intermission comes around, and I go out to the lobby, and I needed to use the bathroom. And the line for the women's bathroom was 350 people long.
Okay, right,
and I
right,
looked
right.
across the lobby, and the line for the men's bathroom was 4 people long.
Right.
And so I said, hey, I'm feeling like a man today. I'm going to go in the men's room because I'll get back and I'll be able to get another drink before the second act starts. And I will tell you, some of the men did not look happy that I was in their bathroom. And I didn't even, I used a stall, obviously, and not a urinal. I'm not going to go that far. But I don't think they were that happy about it. And I think it just, it was kind of quote unquote, their safe space. And I was invading it, and I did it willingly. And I smiled and waved at everyone and said sue me, what are you going to do? But I think that we need to kind of disassociate ourselves with the idea of safe spaces in a bathroom.
Right.
Come on, let's all be safe everywhere. Let's just get over it. I'm not invading your privacy. It's not like I was, I don't know. I felt a little bit of a creep. I don't know.
Okay, my story is a little bit different than your story. I had a similar experience. I was at I was traveling, and I stopped off at this gas station, and there was a guy's bathroom and a girl's bathroom, and I did not quite get in there for the guy's bathroom. Some guy went in there before me and was there forever. I'm talking hours. I was waiting out there. I got to get on the road here. Meanwhile, no one was going in or coming out of the girl's bathroom, and I was just staring over there looking, going, it's a single bathroom. Only one person can be in there at a time. There's a lock. Why shouldn't I just use the girls' bathroom? So I did. I locked the door and used the bathroom. And I got to admit, when I left there, I made sure to duck my head, cover my eyes. No one was going to see me. If there's someone out there, they were not going to be able to ID me other than some 6'2" guy leaving the bathroom. But yeah, I was not as proud as you were. I was definitely in shame. Head hanging in shame. But all right, well, maybe the bathroom deal is not that big of a deal. Again, I do find it interesting. Now, outside of the whole European context, again, Title II does not apply to sex. And so when it comes to public accommodations, you don't have to worry about that. It would just be in the employment context outside of your particular state law. All right, well, let's now move to by the way, before we go to the next case, again, the one of the thought here is, should there be an activist court? And I found it interesting. During oral argument, Chief Justice John Roberts pose that as a question, because Posner below had basically said, you know what, it is the court's job to update outdated laws. So that's what the court was supposed to do. If you have legislation that's been outdated, the courts are supposed to update outdated laws. And the Chief Justice was very condescending about that approach. And he asked the lawyer for the employee whether or not she agreed with that position, said, no, of course you should not be doing that. So I find that interesting in light of that's exactly what the Supreme Court did. So let's just listen now to that exchange.
How do you agree or disagree with Judge Posner's statement that the statute should be read to encompass sexual orientation discrimination to, quote, avoid placing the entire burden of updating old statutes on the legislative branch?
I disagree with Judge Posner. I don't think you need to do any updating here. I think you should read the words as they were understood then, which is men and women. Title VII was intended to make sure that men were not disadvantaged relative to women and women were not disadvantaged relative to men. And when you tell two employees who come in, both of whom tell you they married their partner Bill last weekend, when you fire the male employee who married Bill and you give the female employee who married Bill a couple of days off so she can celebrate the joyous event, that's discrimination because of sex. Well, if no one has any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Well, I think we'll have further questions.
All right, now let's move on to our second case, my exhibit two as to why the American Democratic Experience died last week. This is the case of Department of Homeland Security v. Regents of the University of California. Now, I assume you are very familiar with this case, Mackenzie?
Yes, this is another big one that came out this week, and it has to do with DACA, which is an Obama administration era executive order.
Can you pause while I shudder? You said Obama, so I got to do my shuddering. But then, all right, you said that. Now go on. I'm sorry. I just had to know for the record.
I'm sitting at my desk right now looking at, I have a couple things on my bookcase that faces my desk, that some pictures and, you know, whatever, various awards and accolades that I've received over the years, and they barely fit, let me tell you.
Right, right.
But one thing on my bookshelf is a framed print of Michelle Obama. It's an illustration.
Okay.
You know, an artistic rendering of Michelle Obama, and it says, "When they go low, we go high," which is also on the list of credentials to become a liberal, to get your liberal card. Like, do you think things are better in Europe? Check. Do you have artwork representing Michelle Obama? Check. I'm hitting all the boxes here.
Hey, I'm a conservative. You mentioned Obama. I shuddered. A check. All right, but go on.
Right, but it's called, the executive order was called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Order, I guess. And essentially, it applied to individuals who, you know, reside in the United States who were brought here illegally as children, when their parents came illegally and brought them, and therefore, you know, are out of status, essentially,
right,
immigration-wise. And I guess, you know, under the letter of the law, they would be subject to deportation because their status is not legal.
Exactly.
But President Obama basically said, you know, I'm issuing this executive order because, as we all know, that enforcement of immigration laws is up to the executive branch, that we're not going to enforce this, essentially, and we're going to defer that action.
Right.
And that order came in the wake of Congress failing to pass.
So,
this is a common theme in today's podcast.
Right.
Pass the DREAM Act, which would have legislatively, you know, given those individuals a legal status or a pathway to legal status.
Let me just pause here, right? Just a couple of minutes here, because I want to point out what you just said. First of all, Congress failed to act. That is a consistent theme today. Congress is for whatever reason, maybe Congress is broken. Maybe the political climate is such that they couldn't pass this. People were afraid how they might lose their base. I don't know, but they failed to act. And so Obama created this, this program, if you will, whereas you pointed out, if you were here illegally, you could apply for a 2-year deferment, if you will, where during this 2-year period of time, they would not deport you as long as you were either working or so you're gainfully employed, or you were in a school. So as long as those two things were met, they would not deport you for 2 years, in which case you would have to renew it. And so right there, Mackenzie, are you sitting down?
I'm sitting down.
All right, I'm just going to tell you something, all right? A little confide in you about how I actually think and believe. I like what Obama did. I do. I think this is a good idea. Right? I mean, how could you disagree with this? What are we opposed? Why are a lot of conservatives or Americans opposed to the whole immigration problem? I mean, here's why. You don't want to have open borders and then have a lot of free stuff. Because when you have open borders and you have a lot of free stuff, what that means is people will come over, not work, and just grab up all the free stuff. It's going to be a burden on the tax base. But you know what, Mackenzie, again, I hope you're sitting down. We are all immigrants, unless you are an original American, you know, from a tribe. We're all immigrants, and I have no problem with people who come over here and want to make a better life for themselves and work and pay taxes and go to school. To me, that's all good. So I actually kind of like this program. This makes a lot of sense. So again, I just want to give you my two thoughts. Go ahead and continue with your story.
No, I mean, it's great to hear that. I'm celebrating what you just said. It's wonderful. You might like have half of a check mark on one of the boxes on my liberal card form. So be careful. If you want to check yourself before you wreck yourself here.
Right, but
so, you know, don't, you know, got to like curtail it now, though.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't get too excited. I'll come back. Because here's the problem. What Obama did was illegal. So again, we had the same issue of we have a good thing, a good result, a good outcome, but how he came about it was not in conformity with our laws. He just said, I'm going to do this on my own. And by doing this, it did create a program. It wasn't just simply saying, I'm going to defer prosecution. It's like, I am going to now, you have Social Security benefits, you have other kinds of benefits that come from taxpayer dollars that were conferred upon these people in this program. It was well beyond just simply deferring prosecution. And so because of that, the Fifth Circuit struck down this Obama action and said, no, he didn't. He really went beyond just simply deferring prosecution, and he actually created an affirmative program. So any thoughts on what Obama did being contrary to the law?
I mean, it's not completely wrong, right? And I think when Obama issued the executive order, like he even kind of said, like, I'm only doing this because Congress is totally incapable of doing its job. Like, again, this is another situation where the Dream Act was first introduced in 2001. So we're almost at 20 years now. It was a bipartisan bill. It was introduced by Dick Durbin and Orrin Hatch of all people, you know, and it's been reintroduced many, many, many times, most recently in 2017 when the Trump administration kind of announced that they were going to end DACA. And some of the sponsors, I mean, Lindsey Graham was a sponsor of reintroducing it. And again, it didn't pass, even though I don't have poll numbers on this one. But, you know, I think a majority, at least, of Americans support the Dream Act. It's fairly circumscribed. Like it was a compromise bill, and Congress couldn't even pass a compromise bill. So I think President Obama even said, like, I don't like having to do this, but I feel like I have no choice. And is it illegal? Probably. Is it right? Yes. And I think that's, you know, we agree on this. Like, we agree on what happened here. Yeah. And I guess the fundamental question is, like, are state actors or are leaders obligated to do what is morally right in the face of a constitutional breakdown?
So that is,
you know, or do you go by what Article 1 tells you you can do and say, like, gee, guys, we really need to fix this. I don't, you know, I mean, I obviously come out one way. I think you probably come out the other way, but I don't think either of us is evil or wrong necessarily. Hey. It's just, it's a gray area. There's no, it's not an easy answer here.
So let's unpack the actual law as applied in this case, just because I want to help prove my point. But so Obama got this passed and did not, you know, at least one Fifth Circuit struck it down saying, no, you didn't, you overstepped your bounds. You actually created a program. You created laws and rights. This just simply wasn't deferring prosecution. And so Trump then wins the presidency. And so one of the first things that he did through his attorney general said, we're going to undo what Obama did because it was illegal. Now, should a president not have that right to say, I'm not going to enforce this law or this program, this executive order that my predecessor did that had no basis in law and that was illegal? Shouldn't a president have that right to do that?
No, 100%. And I think the court here, Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion, even said, like, there is no doubt that the Trump administration has the power to end DACA.
Okay.
They just didn't do it the right way. They didn't. And this is a common theme that we've seen in a lot of Trump administration initiatives. I'll say, like, they just don't even, like, pretend to do it the right way or, like, try to have anything more than, like, a laughable pretext for doing what they're doing. And I also think there's another aspect here where, you know, right after this decision came out, or within a couple hours after this decision came out, President Trump tweeted, you know, does anyone else get the impression that the Supreme Court doesn't like me?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, it's a funny tweet because he's like a total narcissist and somehow he made this about him. But I also think he's right. Like, I think after everything that went down back in 2018 between the Chief Justice and President Trump kind of getting into a Twitter war, I really think, this is my personal opinion, I have no evidence to back this up, but I think the Chief Justice, like, really can't stand Donald Trump.
I think he
really strongly dislikes him. I think he thinks that he's, you know, not a smart person and maybe even like a hateful person. And I think it's hard to, you know, put that aside and, you know, just rule based on, you know, other considerations and not let that come into play, especially since there have been other cases where the court and lower federal courts have said, like, guys, this is pretextual. You have to go through the steps. You have to consider the relevant factors that, like, the law requires you to consider before ending the program, even though you do have the power to do it. And, like, it's pretty clear to me that what the Chief Justice is trying to do, because what's going to happen now is that the Trump administration will say, okay, we're going to consider the factors, and they'll, like, issue a memo that says, we consider the factors and we're ending the program, but when's that going to be?
Well, let's unpack
that. There's an election in a couple months, so maybe they're just trying to kick the can and see what happens.
Let's unpack that, because I am way too cynical for my own good. I believe that, even though I kind of agree that Trump seems like an idiot at times, and he does things that are real head-scratchers, I think he's way more of a genius than what we give him credit for. And so here's going to be my take. I don't think he really cared that DACA was his actions were unconstitutional. In fact, this program has still been going on. And he surely should have known. And he has lawyers, very smart lawyers around him. And they surely would have known that, guys, this is a real easy fix. Just put this up, notice this, and then allow for comments, have people give their comments, and then, boom, you can go ahead and pass make this executive decision. That would not have been problematic or tough in the least bit. It would have taken, what, probably 90 days at the outset to do. Very simple. You know, this action was taken several years ago, and surely they knew that's what they could have done. So why didn't they do that? Well, one thought is they don't mind this being the law. They just wanted to keep this as a campaign issue. And that way now the election is coming up and you're going to see Trump rile his base with this, saying, look, we need more conservative justices because the ones we have are going rogue. I need more time to fix this. And when he's had the last couple of years, he could have done this the right way. I'm just wondering, is there another nefarious ulterior motive that they have going on? Any thoughts on that?
That just, like, makes me want to cry because it's so probable and, like, disheartening. Like, there are a lot of people way above my pay grade who are a lot more experienced and smarter than me who, you know the steps that you have to go through to end this order. And yeah, I mean, I've heard many times like the sound bites from Trump's rallies saying, you know, his campaign rallies in 2016 saying, I'm going to end DACA, and people cheering. And,
right.
You know, it just makes me sad because I think that everything, most political issues, you know, have been reduced to these sound bites and these, you know, Twitter, 280 characters or whatever. And a lot of issues, which include things well beyond, you know, LGBTQ rights and DACA, they're so complex. I mean, really, immigration, especially on our southern border, like if you really peel back the layers of the onion, I mean, what it really has to do with is the fact that we're a very wealthy country and we share a thousands miles long land border with a poor country. And there are going to be very complicated, you know, legal, humanitarian, ethical issues that arise in that circumstance. And they deserve a lot more discussion than a soundbite at a political rally or a tweet. It makes me sad because I think most Americans could have the educational and intellectual capacity to fully, or at least like, you know, on a fairly high level, like consider these issues. I believe in my compatriots, and I think we're, you know, on the whole, smart people and good people, but we've allowed ourselves to kind of faction off into these like sports teams of like, this we might as well just have logos at this point, or like a mascot.
I know, it's that bad.
You know, instead of actually having policy debates. So it just makes me sad because I feel like that's probable, or at least possible, that could have been the reasoning behind this. And while I, again, am happy with the result, like it is kind of a sad commentary on the state of our government.
I don't want
to. And again, everyone should get fired, and I should just be running things.
I don't want to contribute to you being sadder, but let me just tell you that now President Trump gets to use DACA as another campaign issue, and you better believe he probably has commercials already in the works that are going to be running, playing this up as why he should be reelected. So don't underestimate the wiliness of these politicians. Now, let me give you another example, which is just coming to my mind now, that kind of proves my point. Do you remember when he campaigned hard for building up a wall between the United States and Mexico? Do you remember that?
I mean, I wish I could forget it, but I recall.
Big campaign issue, right? Huge campaign issue. Build that wall. Well, he was elected, and guess who had control of the House and the Senate after he was elected? I know you know this. It was the Republicans. So he had a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a conservative, you know, Republican in the White House, and a conservative Supreme Court. Do you not think that would have been a good time then to, I don't know, pass legislation on the wall, right? Would that not have made sense? Do you know what he did?
Absolutely.
He did nothing. He sat on it for a year, almost 2 years. Finally, the election was coming up, and it was clear that the Republicans were going to lose the House. And so then they did lose the House. And guess who President Trump, what he then tried to do? He tried to introduce legislation to build the wall. And my thought was, really? You're going to wait 2 years until you lose the House to introduce legislation to build the wall? Why did you wait 2 years? Well, here's the reason why. He didn't want to build that wall. He wanted to
give himself a tax cut, Joel,
And he wanted to blame the Democrats as to why it wasn't being done. He wanted to make that a campaign issue. He didn't care about the actual wall. That's my take on it. It's all about winning the next election.
I mean, you know, I'm not that cynical. I will acknowledge that he was very busy meeting with authoritarian leaders and complimenting them all throughout the globe and giving himself a tax cut to the tune of millions of dollars. It's exhausting. What do you expect a guy to do, you know?
Exactly.
He was really busy.
That was item 3 on his list and didn't quite get to it after everything else. So, yeah, well, there you go. This is the week that the American democracy died. At least that's my take on it now. I might have it. You know what? Maybe, Mackenzie, I am wrong on that. Maybe this is the week that highlighted why the American democratic experience works. Because if Congress won't do something, the Supreme Court will step in and do it for them. And as long as they don't go too far outside the will of the public, it will be received. Any response on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it is kind of depressing when the debate is whether this is the week American democracy died or whether it's been dead for a long time. Like, that's not uplifting. But yeah, I mean, I still think that there is, you know, some hope. I think the fact that, you know, that at least the first decision, the Bostock decision, can be is supported or will be publicly received well by the majority, the vast majority of American people. Like, it is a good result. And I think also the silver lining to, you know, people being so involved on social media and having 24/7 access to so much news and commentary about what's going on is I do think, I hope, and I do believe that the average American voter is becoming more informed about the nuances and the complexities of these issues, which is a good thing. So I think that, you know, there are some glimmers of hope. I agree with the result in both of these cases. I am waiting with bated breath to see what the court does for the next two Mondays, which are the last two opinion days of the term. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Hey, great segue. So stay tuned for us. We'll come back here next week and unpack what the Supreme Court did. Next week, we will debrief the law then. So thank you so much, Mackenzie, for joining me today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.